Welcome to Today's Issues. Join us for the next hour as we offer a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Ed Vitagliano.
And welcome to Today's Issues on this Wednesday, September 19th. I'm sitting in for Tim Wildman today. Walker Wildman is not here. Sitting in for Walker Wildman is Fred Jackson, News Director for American Family News and One News Now. Good morning, Fred.
Great to be sitting here.
Great to be sitting here. And then sitting in for Fred Jackson, since Fred's in Walker's seat, is Chris Woodward, news anchor for American Family News. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Our brother from another mother, Steve, is playing himself later today.
Yes, he'll be on the third segment of the show, starting at 11:05 Central Time. So it's always weird when we have this kind of shifting around. So, Fred, you're technically the co-host.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. You're the co-host.
Does that mean I have to behave myself today?
No. In fact, it means if I were to get choked up or, you know, needed to get some popcorn or something, I could just walk out. You would take over.
Now you're making me nervous.
All right, folks. Well, we've got a lot of news to cover, and Chris is the man with the news. So
yes.
Let's start us off, Chris.
What's happening right now? It's on a lot of television networks. We're going to be talking about it on the radio today. The president, President Trump, is in Cherry Point, North Carolina today to see the damage from Hurricane Florence firsthand. He's also going to be making some stops in South Carolina where there's a lot of damage as well. This, of course, comes just days after Hurricane Florence pretty much destroyed parts of North Carolina, a lot of flooding, homes damaged. We actually have a soundbite here. This is clip two, Brent. This is Al New with the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association's rapid response team of chaplains. He says no matter where you look, there is destruction.
Flooded homes, homes off their foundation, totally destroyed. Presently, the number of homes that have been destroyed here in New Bern alone, over 4,300 homes and over 300 businesses. So it's widespread here. Everybody in the area of New Bern are affected by this event, whether they receive damage to their physical properties or not. They're still emotionally upset and looking for answers to why things like this happen. And a lot of them are saying this has never happened before. They've never seen it like this before. And our chaplains come alongside them and just love on them, try to help them get through this, and give them hope that things are going to get better through Jesus Christ our Lord.
You preach like that in my church, we say amen. I bring this up because, you know, obviously a lot of churches tonight are going to be gathering for what they might call prayer meeting, Bible study, things like that. You know, don't go without offering any kind of prayer. Certainly a lot of people in the Carolinas need your prayer, as well as people even in Hurricane Harvey damaged Texas, still dealing with that. President Trump needs prayer as well. So what do you guys have to say?
It's you know, it's an aspect of this story that you won't get on Fox and other news agencies. They deal with the destruction. That's an important story. But the whole, you know, even as Christians, as this gentleman was addressing, if you're living in these areas and in New Bern, one community, you heard him say, over 4,000 homes destroyed.
Right.
Now, some homes get water damage. You know, groups go in and they replace the drywall and they can move back in. 4,000 homes destroyed, houses destroyed. And so you can understand. I think people in our audience, when you got bad news about something, the understandable question is, I'm one of your kids, Lord.
Yeah.
Why did this happen to me? Why did I lose all of this? What am I going to do?
Right.
Because I'm not insured. And I was watching a Fox report this morning. Some people are already making the decision that the damage is so bad they're not going back.
Right.
So where do you go? We're talking about young families, guys with jobs somewhere and kids in school somewhere. So as Chris says, this is an aspect that we have to remember these people in prayer, because they're facing an uncertain future, and it's a point where these chaplains come in and say, no, God's still in control, and he still has a future for you. But when you're in the midst of this kind of storm, and the after fact, it's almost worse than the storm itself. because now your house is gone. You can't move back into it. What am I going to do? And that's where it takes people coming along and chaplains like this coming along and saying, you know, God is going to take care of things. This is where the Christian community comes along and says, all right, we're going to help you out. We're going to provide you with temporary housing, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and for those who are listening who've never gone through something like this, that would include me. I've never gone through total destruction, you know, like this. You know, we're talking, you know, earthquakes, or people in Hawaii had, you know, volcanoes, and people lost everything. It's the only thing I tried to do in terms of getting some sense of the kind of pressure that these people must come under is you think about your daily life right now and all the stress and all the strain and all the struggles that go on, and then say on top of that, you have nowhere to live, you have no possessions. Some of you, you know, might have insurance, or you have insurance, but you have big deductibles. Now, on top of everything else in life, you got to find a place to live. You've got to start rebuilding your life in terms of getting clothes for kids going to school. I mean, all those kind of things we take for granted. It's a terrible. It must be a terrible ordeal. And as I said, I've never been through it. But the thing that I'm proudest about as a Christian is that we see Christians from all over the country. We're going to be talking to Steve Tiber, founder of 8 Days of Hope, at the bottom of the hour, talking about what that ministry is going to be doing. And so there are thousands of Christians who are ready to drop what's going on in their lives and go and help.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area, people still rebuilding their lives. I know 8 Days of Hope, probably others, are still going back, making trips there to try to bring some semblance of order to people's lives. So absolutely continue to pray. And then, folks, when you get an opportunity to give to Samaritan's Purse, or maybe give to 8 Days of Hope, or to participate in one of their trips, take the time to do that, because there are people, many of whom are not Christians, who hear the gospel, who see the love of Jesus, as total strangers come in and say, we're going to rebuild your house this week. I mean, that's got to be mind-blowing. So anyway, so continue to remember. And listen, there will be, you know, in a few months, there's going to be another disaster. There's going to be something else, you know, coming down the pike, because this is a fallen world. A lot of dangerous things happen, and they happen all over the world, not just in the United States. So just continue to pray and be ready to help. So.
Yeah. Well, before he left the White House for Cherry Point, North Carolina today, President Trump did speak to reporters about the Kavanaugh situation that's playing out in the news. I'll get into the backstory here in just a minute, but this is clip one.
I think he's an extraordinary man. I think he's a man of great intellect, as I've been telling you, and he has an unblemished record. This is a very tough thing for him and his family, and we want to get it over with. At the same time, we want to give tremendous amounts of time. If she shows up, that would be wonderful. If she doesn't show up, that would be unfortunate.
Now, the she there is this Christine Blasey Ford that has accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault when they were in high school. She was 15 at the time of the alleged assault. He was 17 around that age. She has been quoted as saying, through her lawyer, she wants an FBI investigation before she appears to senators to talk about this. And now there are senators saying, we're not going to wait. There was a Daily Caller article this morning quoting Senator Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying, we're not delaying. So here we go again. We're going to be talking about this and covering it as well.
Well, and this is now for those who might say, well, that's terrible. They should investigate this woman's claims. This woman has, she approached and gave a letter to Senator Dianne Feinstein in the summer. And during the hearings, nothing was said. When Democratic senators had their one-on-one interviews with nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh, or had phone calls with them, none of them brought this up. So excuse me for being suspicious of the motives of Democratic senators. Now that we went through the hearing and it became clear that Brett Kavanaugh was going to sail through and be confirmed, then they bring this up. So I am incredibly suspicious of their motives. And I frankly am glad that Republicans are taking a firm stand. If this woman would like to present her case, I like the suggestion that was made. I'm trying to remember who made the suggestion. I read about it yesterday. But that each of the two individuals involved, Brett Kavanaugh and then Ford, Christine mm-hmm. Blasey Ford, each should be questioned by the other's attorney in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That gets senators on both sides off the hot seat. They don't have to be overly aggressive like a defense attorney would. Mm-hmm. Any of us who have watched programs, you know, Law and Order, what have you, understand the job of a defense attorney. Senators don't want to have to do that. You know, Democratic senators don't want to have to do that, I assume, to Brett Kavanaugh. Republican senators sure don't want to look like they're being overly aggressive to Christine Ford. So let the attorneys, both of them have attorneys, let the attorneys do the questioning after the senators can ask some questions. To me, that would be the best solution. But if she does not show up on Monday after throwing this grenade into the mix, I think the Senate Judiciary Committee should just go on and vote.
And to your point, it's really quite interesting. A couple of the Republican senators who initially, after this story broke, said they really felt they couldn't vote out of committee Kavanaugh. And those senators being Senator Flake of Arizona, Jeff Flake, and also Corker of Tennessee, both of which are not running again, but both expressed kind of, they're almost like on the with the Democrat side of this. Now, last night, they're changing the tune. After it was announced that probably Christine Ford is not going to show up on Monday, that they said, well, if she doesn't, then the Judiciary Committee, Flake is on that committee, he says we should go ahead and do the vote anyway. And it's almost, and Corker the same thing. He's obviously in the Senate. He's saying if she doesn't show up, then he's calling on the full for the full Senate vote. So there you have it. I think there's a bit of frustration that's starting to build. You have this big accusation that's out there against this nominee. And she's given the opportunity. Remember, they were supposed to vote tomorrow, the mm-hmm, committee.
Right.
And Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, said, okay, we want to give this a full hearing and set up. First, they were going to do it over the phone and or just right. It was behind closed doors with the committee. But then they said, no, we'll do this in the open. So they give her an opportunity. She could go before the nation and tell her story. But now she's saying, no, I don't want to do that. And so she and through her lawyers are saying they want a full FBI investigation. And this morning on Sandy's show, we played a clip from the Laura Ingraham show last night on Fox and Friends. And the clip is she interviewed former FBI Special Agent John Annarelli. He was asked about this idea of demanding a full FBI investigation. And this is what he had to say.
The reality is the FBI conducts national security investigations for these types of incidents. That investigation has already been completed. There was nothing derogatory found, and that's why it's moved forward. To go back and do an investigation now would not serve any purpose for what the FBI does.
She wanted to testify 24 hours ago. 24 hours later, no, now hot potato ticket to the FBI.
It's been 36 years. Memories fade. But more importantly, this is the type of crime, a sex offense that's being alleged. It's handled by the local authorities. The FBI does not have jurisdiction for those cases.
Well, that's very interesting because that's everyone says, let the FBI do it. And if you say no, then people assume, well, you got something to hide. And what he is saying, what's this individual's name again?
Yeah, he's former FBI Special Agent John Annarelli.
He's saying this is not the FBI doesn't do this. What are you're asking us to do? I like what he said about memories fading, too. I listened to Tucker Carlson, who made a comment. He had a kind of one of his monologues, his statements there where he addressed this. And he said, there's a reason why there are statutes of limitations. He says it's not that a statute of limitation is meant to prevent justice from being done. He says it's so that justice can be done because in certain cases and certain types of crimes, memory, human memory, becomes unreliable. And he makes the great case. He says Can you remember what you were doing on Saturday night, you know, September, whatever, 1982? He says, no, you can't, because our memories fade and certain incidents. So he says, and I like, I think this is true. Once you get past a certain point, if you did not, we've been saying this all week, I have, if you did not file a police report at the time, talking about Christine, I guess you would be Christine Blasey at the mm-hmm. time. If you did not file a police report then, if you did not make comments to people then that could be recalled, if you didn't write it in your diary, if you didn't do any of those things, how can you trust your memory and how are we supposed to corroborate it? So I think it's unfair from a justice standpoint 36 years later to say, well, I'm throwing this out there and I want this man, his confirmation to fail because of my accusation. Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. Laura Ingraham in discussing this and interviewing this former FBI agent last night made mention kind of along the line of what you're saying about memories. Christine Blasey Ford can't even remember where the house was.
She, well, there you go.
And so Laura Ingraham says, are we supposed to go door to door? Is the Chevy Chase Maryland? I think that's the
community. It was in Maryland somewhere.
It's in Maryland somewhere. Are we supposed to now survey the whole city there in Maryland and find a house with a swimming pool in the backyard? Because she remembers a swimming pool in the backyard.
Well, and what weekend was it? I mean, how is Brett Kavanaugh supposed to say, well, I can prove I didn't do it because that weekend I was on a trip with my parents or with a mm-hmm. ball team or something.
Yeah.
If you can't come up with those kinds of details, how do you expect him to defend himself?
Yeah.
So anyway, this is going to be very interesting the rest of the week and over the weekend because this hot potato, mm-hmm. I think that was the Laura Ingraham thing, this is exactly what this is looking like. We have no idea whether or not she's going to show up and what's going to happen if she does.
Well, talking about this whole situation, you know, Dianne Feinstein, or DiFi, as some people have referred to her, she had the information weeks, if not months ago, never brought anything up. And then there have been reports that Ford took a polygraph back in August, which leads people to question, well, you didn't want to come forward, you didn't want your name known, why are you taking a polygraph before we even found out about this? South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who I believe is a member of the Judiciary Committee, he was on Sean Hannity last night talking about the process and determining Kavanaugh's guilt or innocence in this entire situation. Clip 4.
If I believed the person in front of me had committed a serious offense that would disqualify them from being on the Supreme Court, I would bring it up to them. I would not let that go unchallenged. So here's what I'm going to do. This is not that complicated. It's a 36-year-old allegation. It's a serious allegation. Everybody needs to be heard, but also people need to defend themselves. I'm going to look at what she said about Brett Kavanaugh in high school and compare that to everything else I know about Brett Kavanaugh, including his denial, and I'll make a decision. And here's what I want your audience to know. If Ms. Ford really did not want to come forward, never intended to come forward, never planned to come forward, why did she pay for a polygraph in August, and why did she hire a lawyer in August if she never intended to do what she's doing?
Now, I took one law class in college. It was mass media law. It has nothing to do with this. But even I can tell you, an attorney for somebody that's accused would use that against her.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's clear she went to DiFi, Dianne Feinstein, yeah. The senator, in July with the letter. And then started making plans. This is obviously making plans to make this public, to go into the public eye. She takes the polygraph. So the first question somebody asks, well, how do you know? Are you sure? Well, I took a polygraph. Okay. And polygraphs, we talked about this in our story meeting, mm-hmm. are not lie detector tests. All they do is measure your reaction to questions. And if a person believes something happened, or if this terrible thing did happen to Christine Blasey Ford, but she's confusing who it was, you can pass a polygraph test. And that's why they're not admissible in court. But it's clear that she was planning to make this public before she said, I wasn't sure whether I was going to make this public. I'm just not buying that.
Well, and let's remind people, when Senator Dianne Feinstein made this public right at the last minute, after the Judiciary Committee had completed hearing testimonies, she brings this up.
Yes.
And she was asked, well, If you had the letter in July, why didn't you do it? Senator Dianne Feinstein told the United States people, well, I didn't bring it up then because she didn't want it brought up.
Right.
So now what Senator Lindsey Graham is saying, well, wait a minute. That's what you told us, Senator Feinstein, but Christine Ford had a polygraph test in August when you were still under the impression, Dianne Feinstein, she didn't want to talk about this. So something is not adding up in all of this. Not only did she take a polygraph test in August, she lawyered up.
Right.
Well, you're like, why do you hire a lawyer if you don't want to make public this, if you want to keep it a secret? It just starts to smell like a plot.
Well,
that was hatched weeks ago.
Yes, this is our Trump card. Forgive me, it's hard to use that anymore. But this, so that if it looks like he's going to be voted and confirmed, we have one more card to play. Mm-hmm. And there are other things that enter into this. First of all, she's a lifelong Democrat and an activist. Talking about Christine Blasey Ford. Now, that doesn't excuse, you know, a sexual assault if it happened. I'm just saying, in trying to figure out what her motivations might be. The other thing that is just bizarre about this is that Christine Blasey Ford's parents lost their home when they had to go before a judge, and it was a foreclosure case, and the judge that presided over that foreclosure case in which her parents lost their home was Brett Kavanaugh's mother.
Yeah.
Now, come on. I've got to say that these are the kind of things that just make this kind of a bizarre thing, plus the fact that it is entirely possible in my mind that if this did happen, who knows whether she was drunk. I don't know. If this did happen, how do we know she's not confusing the individual who did it with Brett Kavanaugh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that's why I say I don't know who's telling the truth. And frankly, you can't come forward 36 years later and force a man who's on the verge of being confirmed to the Supreme Court, force a man to defend himself over charges that were never made 36 years ago.
Yeah. You know, about this time last year, I just looked this up, Feinstein told judicial nominee Amy Coney Barrett this, "The dogma lives loudly within you, and that's a concern." 1 year later, going in front of the whole Kavanaugh situation, obviously the Democratic Party dogma lives loudly within Feinstein, and I think most people listening would agree that is a concern.
All right, do we have anything we can squeeze in here?
Well,
in about
yeah,
the next
I do want to throw this in. You kind of wonder what impact does something like this, the confirmation process, have on a nominee's family? Steve found this. It's an article from 2005 from The New Yorker, and it was an interview with Karl Rove, then at the Bush administration. He said the most painful example of a confirmation process at that time was a guy named Miguel Estrada, who had worked in the Solicitor General's office and was President George W. Bush's first appellate court nominee in 2001. Really lengthy, hard, difficult confirmation process. Estrada withdraws his name 28 months after being nominated. Come to find out, during the confirmation struggle, Estrada's wife miscarried. And in November of 2004, she died of an overdose of alcohol and sleeping pills, which was initially ruled, her death was ruled accidental. Rove is quoted as saying she had been traumatized by the nastiness of the process and actually had conversations with Senator Harry Reid saying, we need to sit down and talk and fix all this.
I remember the Estrada nomination. It went over 2 years. It was disgusting. And I'm just telling you, the Democrats have politicized that process, where Republicans will vote on qualified nominees like Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. Democrats won't. And they play hardball, and they don't care what human wreckage they leave behind them. So that seems to be what's going on here as well. My sympathies to Dr. Ford, whatever happened, whoever did it, we will never know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's time to move on. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back.
On the next Today's Issues, our guest will be Dr. Alex McFarland of Exploring the Word.
I want to say a big shout out to some listeners, if they can hear us, in the Carolinas, great cities like Mullins, South Carolina, Dillon, Florence, Eastern North Carolina is big for AFR listeners.
We'll also have news headlines and analysis from American Family News reporters. Don't miss the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on American Family Radio. Here's Steve Tiber.
8 days of hope started after Hurricane Katrina, helping people in Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi, rebuild their homes back in 2005. Since then, this faith-based ministry has gone nationwide, and we've helped out dozens of cities, dozens of areas of the country after hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, or even snowstorms. And now you get a chance to be a difference maker. 8 Days of Hope 16. You can be the hands and feet of Jesus down in Houston from October 13th to October 20th. You can come for as little as 3 days or stay all 8 days. We provide the food and lodging. We're looking for skilled professional and people like me who are less skilled and just want to give back. For more information, go to our website, 8daysofhope.com. Click on the event, 8 Days of Hope 16, read the FAQs, and learn more about how you can make a difference with 8 Days of Hope.
Learn more and sign up to be a part of 8 Days of Hope 16 in Houston, Texas at 8daysofhope.com. That's 8daysofhope.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next. Since 1971, Liberty University's values have been defined by a commitment to excellence and a biblical worldview. Their mission of training champions for Christ has remained the foundation of everything they do. It's that mission that propels Liberty students to excellence in the classroom and beyond. More than 550 programs of study from undergrad to doctoral degrees, effectively preparing students to enter a competitive job market. Visit liberty.edu to learn more. That's liberty.edu. There's been quite a bit of buzz in the mainstream media over the sexual orientation of Bert and Ernie. I'm not quite sure why, but it's what they're talking about on Main Street and Sesame Street. Mark Saltzman joined Sesame Street as a writer in 1984. He told the LGBT website Queerty that Bert and Ernie are a gay couple. He said the characters are a reflection of his own same-sex partnership. Sesame Street quickly shot down that narrative. They said emphatically that Ernie and Bert are not gay lovers. They also reminded the nation they're puppets, and puppets do not have a sexual orientation. Bert and Ernie first appeared on Sesame Street in 1969, teaching preschoolers about what it meant to be good friends. So, for the record, Bert and Ernie are not gay. They're just friends, and America needs to get off the internet and get a hobby. I'm Todd Starnes.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman. I'm joined in studio by Fred Jackson, who's news director for American Family News and One News Now, and then Chris Woodward, news anchor for American Family News. Well, folks, we talked about at the beginning of the program, we've done that every day this week, talking about the devastation that has been wreaked. I guess I'm not sure I'm using the right word. The devastation wrought by Hurricane Florence. And so we want to welcome to the program Steve Tiber, founder of 8 Days of Hope and Hope Reigns. Steve, welcome back.
Hey, guys. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, we're doing great. Now, Steve, before we get to the very serious nature story for which we have you on the phone, we do have to ask you two questions that are a little bit more lighthearted, okay?
Okay.
First of all, you're up in Buffalo. Has it started to snow yet? Fred wants to know.
Well, we don't know. We're talking about the NFL player that quit at halftime on our team. So a lot of crazy things going on up in Western New York, but no, I think we get another day or two before it starts coming.
Okay, and now that you have brought up the Buffalo Bills, this is the second question. Chris Woodward was sitting here during our break. We were preparing to have you on, and he said, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Steve Tiber was actually at the Buffalo Bills playoff game when they mounted that epic comeback against, I guess they were still the Houston Oilers mm-hmm. back then. Were you at that game, Frank Reich?
January 1993, my dad and I had season tickets. We paid $40 a seat. At halftime, we were getting blown up. And I said, let's go. It's cold. And my dad said, I paid $40. We're not leaving until the last play. So we watched Frank Reich lead back that victory. As you know, Frank is a believer.
Yes.
Frank has spoken at multiple 8 Days of Hope events. We've become very good friends. He was an ambassador for the ministry for many years, and now he's the head coach of the cult. So that's a long answer. I was there, wow, along with 300 other thousand people that claim they were there that day, but I wasn't there, I promise you.
All right. For those who have never heard of that, you just look up Buffalo Bills epic comeback against the Oilers. There may be something on YouTube still. That was a phenomenal moment. All right. Well, you brought up Frank Reich and speaking at 8 Days of Hope. Let us know what 8 Days of Hope is doing in the of Florence.
Well, right now, all hands are on deck. You know, we're primarily an all-volunteer organization. God has blessed us with millions of dollars of equipment over the last 13 years that he has sent our way. And we are launching our largest rapid response effort ever. As you know, Harvey hit Houston. We were here within 48 hours, and then we were here for 7.5 weeks with 2,000 people. It was free for the volunteers. We provided the food and lodging, and we helped thousands of families gut their homes, take everything, all the water out, dry it out, and then spray it for mold. And we shared the gospel along the way. It was an amazing, amazing a very tough effort, but it was an amazing effort. Well, this effort is going to even be bigger. And so we've never done this before, so we really need your prayers. We normally focus on one disaster at a time, but I'm right now in Houston preparing for our next rebuilding trip here to help Harvey in October. Meanwhile, we have leaders and equipment headed to New Bern, North Carolina, and then Fayetteville, North Carolina, where we're going to be the next 8 weeks. So it's going to be a very busy time for the ministry, but all hands are on deck. We're accepting volunteers on our website. We're looking for the additional resources we're going to need. But this is an amazing opportunity for the church to be the church.
Steve, it's Fred here. The team that will be going into New Bern, and it's this Sunday, I guess, is when it's launched. September 23rd, is it?
Yes, sir. It starts this Sunday, and you can volunteer today, but volunteers will start arriving Sunday afternoon.
Okay. What kinds of talent are you looking for at this point? We're so fresh after, it's just a week after Florence roared through that area. So what are you looking for?
So here's the good news. Our rapid response, we're willing to take the professional carpenter, electrician, plumber, and painter. But this is a perfect opportunity for somebody like me who's less skilled, you know, handling equipment, because think about it. We're going to go into a house. We're going to use pumps and get all the water out. We're then going to muck it or gut it. And if you can swing a hammer and carry debris to a curb, if you can help a homeowner try to salvage what they're trying that is salvageable, if you can move some dehumidifiers and fans into a house from a truck, if you can make sandwiches, if you can provide transportation or drive equipment from place to place, there's a place for you. So we always say there's no non-skilled volunteers. They don't exist, maybe less skilled. So you can be less skilled, medium skilled, or super skilled. We need you in North Carolina over these next 8 weeks. And that's how long we're going. We're going to go for 8 weeks. We're going to go to 4 weeks in New Bern. Meanwhile, we've got equipment going to Fayetteville today. We have commercial dehumidifiers and fans going to our partner church in Fayetteville. We'll have leaders training volunteers there tomorrow, and then we'll be going to Fayetteville when we pull out of New Bern in about 4 weeks.
Hey, Steve, it's Chris here. Share with us some of the things that storm victims have said to you and the other volunteers that have showed up to help out.
It's usually the most commonly asked question when a homeowner meets strangers at their house who they've, of course, never met. And after about 3 hours, 4 hours of helping them, the homeowner, the family member, usually with tears in their eyes, they say, why would you come from Chicago or Jackson, Mississippi or Rochester, New York? Why would you come to New Bern, North Carolina? And then they have 3 minutes. We coach them that you have 3 minutes to share your story of why God asked you and commanded you to go love and serve people in need. And that's when the Holy Spirit starts to move. That's when we start getting a chance to pray for the homeowners. Sometimes it's storm-related. Sometimes it's about family members. Sometimes it's about their health or finances. But that's when the relationship starts. See, people focuses, and I get it. The media loves seeing 4,600 volunteers in Houston. I get it. I mean, who can repair 800 homes in 2 weeks in Houston? Not us, but only God. So the media loves that. But what I love is what happens when we serve people. The homeowners, they're not only touched, the family members aren't only touched, But the volunteers go home, they're changed too. Man, they're exhausted, but man, their heart is so full because they saw God in action. Oh, it's awesome.
Steve, I know there are people listening right now whose hearts are being touched. And folks, if you're listening, I just want to encourage you. Don't wait for an audible voice. Chances are it's not going to happen. But your heart is being touched right now to give or perhaps to volunteer or to follow up in some way to see how you can help. And as you heard Steve Tiber, who's founder of 8 Days of Hope, what he has just said is we will take anyone who can do anything. Anyone can make a sandwich. If you can carry debris to a dumpster, you can help. So, Steve, for those people who are saying, yeah, I got to do something, how do they find out what they can do and how to do it? Where do they go?
Great. Easiest place is our website. You know, we're a volunteer organization. And so we have people manning phones and manning the computer. But the best thing to do is go to 8daysofhope.com, spelled the number 8, 8daysofhope.com, and just click on volunteer on the main page. You want to volunteer to go to North Carolina. You'll see some FAQs, frequently asked questions. It will tell you that you have to be 18. You have to get there, but once you get there, it's free. We're going to give you a couple good-looking shirts, a safe place to sleep. We're going to feed you really well. You're going to have a hot shower. We have all the tools you would need. But if you're 18 and above, we would love to have you come. We're going to be there for 4 weeks in New Bern. You can come for one day or stay all 28 days. And then right from New Bern, we're going to move over to Fayetteville. So, again, there's no reason why if you live in that part of the country, even outside the part of the country, if you can find 2, 3, 4, or 5 days over the next 8 weeks, you will never forget that vacation. I'm telling you, I love the beach. I love, you know, traveling. There's nothing like meeting a family in the front lines for Jesus and then leaving knowing that you made a huge difference in someone's recovery.
And Steve, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The other thing I would suggest, the resources. We have some partners, and they cover all of our fixed costs. To respond not only to Harvey in Houston in October, but we're going to be in Florence for a long time, in the Carolina for a long time. And then very quickly we'll start thinking how we can help these families rebuild. So, if you're looking for an organization to help with a financial gift, they can give that online. Every penny that is given is going to be spent in North Carolina, not on a salary, not on an office. And again, all of our fixed costs are covered. So, and lastly, prayers. Man, I'm telling you, if you can't come, I get it. If you can't give, no problem. But we need to be praying that the church responds in a way that people are drawn to Jesus, not because of 8 Days of Hope, not because of Samaritan's Purse. There's a lot of great organizations out there, but because they saw Jesus in action. Let's be praying that people's lives, even though right now they're going through chaos, that they realize our God is a God of order, and he's got a plan, and he is good, and he loves them, and he's sending help right now as they're waiting for someone to show up.
Steve, give the website one more time so folks can connect with you guys.
Yeah, 8daysofhope.com. You can also send something to our P.O. Box. It's P.O. Box 3208, 3208 Tupelo, Mississippi 38803. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You'll be able to stay up to date with the pictures and what's going on. And if something changes, man, AFR, you guys are awesome. You've been with us since day one. Day one. 80% of our volunteers come because they hear about 8Days of Hope on AFR. So, guys, thank you so much. You guys are amazing. AFR, you've never charged a penny to promote what God is doing. You've always been there right there on the front lines for all these families, these 46 communities we've helped in. So thank you, guys. I appreciate you so much. We appreciate you so much.
Well, Steve, we appreciate what you guys are doing. It's an honor for us to come alongside and help in any way we can. And so, Steve, thanks for being on the program with us today. And God bless you and the others with 8 Days of Hope as you continue to reach out to people for Jesus. Appreciate that.
Thank you, brother. And please, people, don't forget Houston. A major hurricane is a 5 to 10 year journey. And so it's been 13 months. I met a widow this morning. She's been living in a tent waiting for someone to come help her. So regardless of where you live, there's a place for you to help through 8 Days of Hope.
Wow. All right. Thanks, Steve.
God bless you guys.
That's incredible. 13 months since Houston.
I know. Just
and she's living in a tent.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of thing that Steve Tiber, 8 Days of Hope, and And there are other ministries like, you know, Samaritan's Purse and others, and we appreciate them. But, you know, we've had this partnership with 8 Days of Hope since the beginning.
Right.
As Steve was saying, and the response is incredible. Now, he's thanking us, and we're thanking our listeners.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you folks are making this happen.
Well, like he said, 80% of their volunteers have heard about an outreach through mm-hmm. AFR. So we do have that kind of link with this mm-hmm. ministry. Mm-hmm. And to your point, Fred, thank you to our listeners who participate.
You are the best, folks. You are the best.
Yeah. I just, you know, one of the things I just want to stress as well is not only does this, something that Steve said just kind of clicked with me, but he said, not only are people reached with the gospel and the love of Jesus, but the volunteers go home changed.
Yes.
You know, we hear that a lot when people go on a short-term mission trip to Jamaica or someplace like that. It really is a shock to find out at the kind of about the kinds of suffering that are going on in this world. And so people are changed. And when you reach out to people and you see this kind of devastation, it increases your thankfulness, your gratefulness for what you have. It sharpens your understanding of the fact that this world is not our home,
mm-hmm.
and that everything that we enjoy in life is temporal.
Mm-hmm.
It's here and gone. But that Jesus loves people who are suffering, and it's a great opportunity to love people that God loves as well.
I think God put within the fabric. He made us. He put within our fabric a pleasure in serving. And let's be honest. Many times we don't activate that fabric.
Right.
It takes
a good way of putting it.
It takes an incident like this where you go and you see the mess of people's lives, in this case physical, you know, where they're going to flooded areas, etc. But you also see the look of desperation on a person's face. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know, not only is my home in a wreck, but the job where I work, that building is gone too.
Yeah.
So I don't have a job. I don't have a home. Along come these people from, as Steve was saying, from Rochester, New York, or all over the country. We are here to help you get your life back together again.
Yeah.
And then you see that response, and that activates something inside you.
Yeah.
This is what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Is to serve others.
Right.
And to be a blessing to others. So.
And to love our neighbors.
And that's why 8 Days of Hope is a success.
Yes.
Doing God's work.
Right.
It's always going
and
to be.
And God provides for it.
And God provides.
All right. Well, we are going to get a little bit of whiplash here, moving from the devastation of Hurricane Florence to the devastation of our culture in terms of the sexual revolution. We want to welcome to the program Stephen Baskerville, who is professor of government at Patrick Henry College, fine institution. He's author of the book, The New Politics of Sex, Civil Liberties and the Growth of Governmental Power. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, listen, this is a phenomenal book about a very disturbing topic in terms not only of the devastation of the sexual revolution, but it's seeping into, it's probably not the right word, but seeping into the power of an ever-expanding federal government, which then in turn is reaching into all sorts of areas of our lives. For the sake of our listeners, can you just briefly define the sexual revolution and what you mean by the new politics of sex?
Sure. Well, first of all, I define it a little more broadly than most Christians and even Christian groups do. Much of what Christians have gone to battle against, quite rightly, about the sexual revolution includes things like abortion, of course, the LGBT homosexual agenda, and transgenderism more recently. I try to show that it's bigger than that, that there's a lot more issues involved, and that they're all connected. They're all promoted by the same sexual ideologues, revolutionaries. And there's a lot of things that Christians especially have not paid attention to. For example, the whole area of accusations of things like these newfangled crimes that we hear about nowadays, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual this and that. For example, the Me Too phenomenon and the Harvey Weinstein and all of that. Christians have been kind of left out of the dialogue on that. We've kind of marginalized ourselves by not taking this into account. And so I try to step back and show the larger picture. show where a lot of this, one of my themes is that this originated, much of this originated in the divorce culture, where much of the measures, the legal mechanisms were put into place decades ago, back in the 70s. And that this has been expanding gradually since then, much of it under the radar screen.
Steve, Rhett Jackson here. We're talking a lot right now about the nominee for the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh. And, of course, the latest story on that is an accusation from 36 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is just one case, but as I think you're alluding to, but we don't understand now the power in the politics of the sexual revolution. And so you have this case, you have Baronelle Stutzman, the florist in Washington State, losing her job, losing everything that she has because of an allegation that she has hatred for homosexuals. The courts believe her.
Exactly. This is what I call the politics of accusation. We don't debate things anymore. We level accusations of crimes or quasi-crimes, often things which most people have never heard of. They're not well-defined. They can be stretched to fit any case. And it's virtually impossible to defend yourself against these kind of accusations once they're leveled at you. And this kind of thing, we're seeing this against Christian groups today, and who, especially by the LGBT lobby. But it's very important to understand that this has been going on for decades, and it's been the victims have often been ordinary men, usually men, sometimes women, in areas like domestic violence accusations, rape accusations, sexual assault, again, divorce courts. And it has to be said that Christians have been kind of silent about this. They have not stepped up and been forthright in condemning this. And so it's now coming after us. So my aim is to show the larger threat, the larger danger, and especially the involvement of the state as driven, as rationalized by radical ideology. But I also have a positive message in this, too, that I think that the more we look at the big picture, the more we build a bigger coalition. We need to reach out to other people in the society whose lives have been devastated by this. So I think the book offers hope in the sense that the bigger coalition, the silent majority, if you like, of people who are very much fed up with or victimized by many different aspects of the sexual revolution.
Dr. Baskerville, it's Chris here. It's kind of a loaded question, but I think we can help you here. What are news outlets and talk shows not focusing on or asking you about that we can help you share?
It depends on the outlets. The Christian groups tend to focus on the standard issues which I mentioned. Others don't ask me a lot about how this came out of the divorce machinery, the governmental divorce machinery, because that was really when the government got into the business of breaking up families, forcibly breaking up families in many cases. It got into the business of creating new punishments and new judicial procedures and crimes, if you like, that there aren't really crimes. It's when government first got into the business of basically a witch hunt against mostly heterosexual men, but others as well. And so we need to look, again, we need to look at how this, marriage and we talk a lot about marriage, we talk a lot about sexual morality, but we haven't gone into we haven't really come to grips with what happened 40 years ago with the advent of no-fault divorce and the whole huge government machinery that's grown up around it.
We're talking with Stephen Baskerville, who's professor of government at Patrick Henry College. The book we're discussing with the professor is his book titled The New Politics of Sex, Civil Liberties and the Growth of Government Power. Folks, if you want a kind of a roadmap of how this all happened and how the government got involved with everyone's lives and the fallout from that, get a copy of this book, The New Politics of Sex. Stephen, let me ask you this. Now, I don't think anybody denies anymore, anybody who's sane and can put two thoughts together, that our culture has become incredibly sexualized. Sex is everywhere. I don't think anybody argues that. Now, here's my question. Is this simply a sign of the decay of Western civilization, or is this a part of a broader strategy? I'm thinking in terms of what people call cultural Marxism. You mentioned ideology. Is it both?
Well, it's both, but I like to see it chronologically. I think we've gone beyond the cultural decadence, the cultural decay, and we've moved into a realm where it has become a political ideology. This is another theme of the book, is how we've created a secular political ideology what's really a kind of secular theology. It's what the radicals have essentially done, and you can see this in the Me Too cases and Harvey Weinstein. They've first denigrated Christian sexual morality. They ridiculed terms like fornication and adultery and sin itself, and made it difficult to use these terms. And what have they done? They've come in and they've replaced it with their own form of sin, or rather crime, government-approved sin. But it takes it uses ideological terms: misogyny, sexism, sexual harassment, sexual this and sexual that. So we've basically first they chased out, they denigrated traditional morality, and now because it created chaos, of course. They've replaced that. They're trying to put order into the chaos by imposing their own secular theology, secular sexual morality. And this fools a lot of Christians. A lot of Christians go along with this, and they say, well, Harvey Weinstein is certainly not a nice man. He's, you know, we certainly can't condone this. So they jump on the bandwagon. But the bandwagon they're jumping on is not the bandwagon of traditional morality, of you know, the biblical morality. It's the bandwagon of a secular ideology. So they've effectively, what they've done is they've driven out morality and replaced it with ideology. And this is very subtle, but very dangerous.
Steve, you say there's a coalition, you feel, a positive side of this. As people become more aware of it, there's a coalition that's willing to fight back. Where are the arenas where you fight back on this matter?
Oh, there's a number of them. It's important because Christians have not been involved in them. One of them is the arena of divorced parents, especially divorced fathers. They are the worst system of repression, the worst governmental repression that this country has ever instituted, and I can defend that, is against divorced fathers and the divorce courts. I mean, it's just terrorizing. My previous book details that. But they've spread out from that group to others. University students falsely accused of rape and sexual harassment. University professors also is another hotbed of this place, of these accusations, as are the commanding heights of the economy, of course. You know about Hollywood and television and so forth. But these are the areas that the Christians need to get involved in. Not that we have to say that, you know, university students who engage in hookup culture and you know, the kind of orgiastic culture of the universities, you don't have to condone that. It's not to be condoned. You can make an argument that they are, you know, even students who are unjustly condemned by the human authorities are justly punished by God. And this is an old theological distinction I think we need to bring back, because they're asking for trouble. But that doesn't mean that we should condone the perversion of our legal system to be bringing accusations of things like rape and, you know, assault against people who are guilty of immorality and awkwardness sometimes.
Stephen, we got about 45 seconds. Let me just ask you one last question. Just get as simple an answer as you can give us. Radical sexual ideologies dominate the university campuses virtually across the country. Is there any hope for colleges and universities? I'm talking primarily public institutions.
I think there is. I think the hope is the Christian institutions. I mean, the classical liberal arts, as we try to show at Patrick Henry College, had its origins in the, you know, the Christian church. And that was the ethic that underlay the whole thing. But the Christian churches, the Christian universities and the Christian churches are not speaking out about this. And this, I've written some articles in Crisis magazine about this, about how the Christian colleges need to be more forthright. They need to research these matters, provide alternative scholarship, alternative polemic, if you like, and they need to speak out about this. We have a, you know, code of conduct here at Patrick Henry College, but the federal government wants us to adopt their sexual harassment code.
Right.
Why should a Christian institution even need that?
Stephen, we're going to have to let you go. This has been a very interesting discussion. Folks, get a copy of The New Politics of Sex. Stephen Baskerville is the author. Professor, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a five-minute break for news, and when we come back, Steve Jordahl will be in to give us some further insights into what is happening both here and abroad. Again, a five-minute break for news. Please join us when we come back. You're listening to Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.